Good evening. Venerable Children has been involved in a webinar this afternoon, and so we're going to have one more week of reviewing debate before she returns next week and continues with Chapter 23. So this evening, let's begin with our motivation. I'd like to share with you a quote that I pulled off of a teaching from His Holiness. A couple of weeks ago, I had a couple of days of retreat in one of our cabins, and I was listening to some teachings that His Holiness gave in, is it Riga? These teachings were on the Pramanavarka. There was just four of them. I listened to two of them, and they were so inspiring. And I found this quote that I think, well, it's a quote of His Holiness, that I think can inspire our study tonight. He said, in Nagarjuna's treatise on the middle way, for example, it says, not from self, not from other, not from both, or causelessly. They use logical reasoning to prove the reality of things on the level of basis, path, and result. And because of the importance of logic and reasoning, we have in the Nalanda tradition masters like Dignaga and Dharmakirti writing texts on epistemology, logic, and reasoning. In order to demonstrate the reality of the basis, path, and result, not just resorting to scriptural authority. And so the source of this emphasis on logic and reasoning is in one sutra where the Buddha says, O monks and scholars, just as gold is tested by burning, cutting, and polishing, likewise you should test my teachings and accept it, not because you have devotion or faith in me. And so the Buddha says, my followers, you monks and scholars, must not believe in my teachings because of the reason that you are my disciples and followers. He says you must actually analyze and investigate the teachings. And when you see the significance of these teachings after your investigation, and you should actually not just investigate it, but test if it's helpful and beneficial to you in your practice. And if you are able to verify its significance through your own experience, through your own practice, then you should respect and accept the teachings. So I found this to be very strong personal advice, and I'm rejoicing that we've had the opportunity to go through the debate book. Not only that, but receiving teachings the last couple of years from Geshe Thapke on Pramanavartika, and also the continuous teachings we have on the Lamrim. We are just so fortunate here. And so tonight, as we continue to review some of the topics that we've covered in the debate book, and let's really rejoice that we have these tools that we can use in our analysis, our investigation of the teachings, especially those teachings which are hidden, like proving emptiness, proving past and future rebirths, proving karma. So with that in mind, then let's engage in the teachings tonight, and with a strong remembrance that we're doing this not just for our own edification, our own benefit and well-being, but truly so that we can increase our ability to be of greatest benefit to all beings. I was very surprised when I heard this quote, because often, well, I have heard a number of times people question where this logic and reasoning came from. Was it something that Dignaga and Dharmakirti just made up? But I like the way that His Holiness linked it back to the Buddha's teachings. So, tonight, what are we going to do? I'll tell you what I have in mind. This morning when I began preparing for this evening's class, I started looking through chapter 23. It's a very long chapter, and it is full of so much. And I wonder, I hadn't taken the time to go back and really go through it step by step to see how it's building and progressing to actually give us the procedures in debate. That's the title of the chapter, Procedures in Debate. So I thought tonight we could begin by just walking back through the chapter to see how Dan is guiding us to put the building blocks together. Because at this point, it's kind of like he's throwing us into the water. You know, when you learn to swim, someone can tell you about the strokes, and someone can take you to the shallow end and hold you while you're pretending to paddle. But at some point, you know, you have to go on your own. Or when you're learning to ride a bike, as Venerable Sumtan was reminding us of, at some point, you fall over a lot, and then at some point, you just go. So we're at that point in the text where we're being given the opportunity to go with a debate. And I find for myself, I'm a little bit tenuous. Like, ooh, there's so many options. At every turn, there's so many options. And I find I have a little trepidation about, well, I'm not sure I know what to do. But I think we're at the point where we need to just jump in and start practicing with each other outside of class. So I think we're pretty familiar with syllogisms and consequences that the challenger can pose at the beginning of the debate. We're learning about possible answers that the challenger's statements answers. Let's see. Let's have a look. It starts on page 345. So there's a little bit of an introduction. And then the first thing we're looking at here is the defender's answers. So he says, we're now familiar with the arguments, both syllogisms and consequences, that the challenger can pose. So what are the defender's possible answers to these arguments? And so he breaks this out. Yes, this is chapter 23 for the procedures in debate for those who are on the Kindle version or an ebook. And then going under the defender's answer in that chapter. So we have two sections here. Answers to a two-part consequence with a subject and a point of clarification. And then to a three-part consequence, complete with a reason. So remember here that he makes the distinction that it doesn't matter whether there's a thesis or a point of clarification, but rather how a person responds, but rather the thing that determines how we respond is whether there's just a subject and a predicate, or there's a subject, a predicate, and a reason. Right? So the point of clarification, just to keep that in mind, is for all intents and purposes, it's a thesis, but it's a thesis within a syllogism. It could be something that makes sense. It could also be something that's absurd. But when we have a subject and a predicate, whether it's the thesis or the point of clarification, then we have two options of how we respond, right? And you know what those are? They are? Why? Or? I accept. Very good. Okay. Then going on to a three-part consequence, complete with a reason. So again, that could be a correct reason, a subject, a predicate, and a reason that actually includes the three modes. Or it could be an absurd consequence that's thrown to as a follow-up to someone's statement. Again, it's going to have a subject, a predicate, and a reason. But either the reason won't be established or the pervasion won't. There's no pervasion, or both. It could be both. So to that three-part consequence or three-part syllogism, we have how many responses?
Four.
Okay, so they include reason not established. That's the first thing we look at, right? And if the reason is not established, we don't go any further with that syllogism. We stop there and then try to ferret out what do we do next. If the reason is established, then you look at pervasion. And there were two things, two types of pervasions, weren't there? Yeah, there's the regular pervasion. And then there's a refined, a subset of no pervasion, which is the pervasion is opposite, or opposite pervasion. And then the last option is to say, I accept. You know, it all makes sense. And you could, a defender could say, I accept when there's a correct reason. The defender could also say, I accept when there's not a correct reason. So at any juncture, you know, we have to continue checking. I found in Dan's book, Debate, this point he made, He said, keep in mind that debate is a process for establishing what is irrefutable. In the process of debate, what is well-founded and established by valid or reliable cognition will come to light, while that which is not factually concordant will also become apparent through the use of consequences. So what we're trying to do here is find out either if we're using the consequences and syllogisms on our own thinking or the thinking of a Dharma friend, then we're trying to find, where is there faulty reasoning here? And if it is, then we'll begin to see it through checking for the three modes, or what is it Venerable calls them? The three aspects? Three modes, three aspects, I think. They're called the three modes, typically, in the Tariq books. Okay, so that's the first section of the book. And hopefully by now, because of the practice we've done, these are pretty familiar in our mind. We're pretty comfortable with them. Then there was this funny section where he compared Tibetan logic to Western logic, and we skipped over that, thank goodness. Okay, so we skipped a few pages there, and then we went to a section called The Order of the Answers on page 359. Okay, so here he's just spelling out what I was saying a minute ago, and that is, first we check to see if the reason is established. That's the very first thing that we're looking for. And so by doing that, we look to see, is the reason a quality of the subject? The next thing we check is, and he makes a note that even if the thesis or the point of clarification, in other words, the subject and the predicate, have some reasonable relationship, even if it's correct, if the reason is not established, we don't even look at that. We don't even go any further with that. Then if the reason is established, we check to see if there is pervasion. So the reason I thought to highlight this is because throughout the last year and a half or so, when we've been doing debates, we have gone ahead and checked the pervasion, even if the reason wasn't established. So it's important to make a strong mental note about this. And then if there is no pervasion, just taking a quick look to see if the pervasion is actually opposite. In other words, are the reason and the predicate contradictory? They oppose each other. And then if the reason is established and there is pervasion, then we would accept the argument. So there's a nice little diagram, Defender's Answers Decision Tree, on the top of page 361. And it's a schematic about how we go about this. So it's worth spending some time looking at that and keeping that in mind. So is the reason established? You can go one of two ways. If it's no, then that means the reason is not established, and you would stop there. If the answer is yes, then you check, is there pervasion? If there's no pervasion, then you'd check to see, is the pervasion opposite? Again, there's two points. Yes, then that's the answer. The pervasion is opposite. Or no, then it's just simply there's no pervasion. Or if we go back, is there pervasion? Yes, then you say, I accept. Okay, then the next section is learning to spell out our answers. And he makes the point that there are two reasons that we do this, especially as beginners in debate. One is to make sure that we're not just answering randomly. You know, you're debating with somebody and they're just throwing out different answers like reason not established, no pervasion. And I've seen this a few times here, but I certainly saw this a lot in my previous, where I lived before. There would be not even a syllogism, but a thesis put out, and someone would say, reason not established. There's no reason given. You can't say reason not established. You know, that shows there's a little bit of guessing going on. We're not actually checking the three modes. So, you know, we've had enough practice here that we should be able to answer these well. But he goes through it again, learning to spell out our answers. So, let's see. So if the challenger puts forward a statement like it follows that the subject of pot is permanent, and the defender says why, that'd be the first answer, then the challenger can say, spell out your answer why. You're asking for more information. Why are you saying why? Why is a pot permanent. Oh, okay. So when he says why, when the defender says why, they're saying, why is a pot permanent? You know, I don't believe you. And that can mean either, please give me a reason, give me more information about why you're saying this, or no, that's just wrong. It's not going to fly. Okay. Then again, with all four of these answers, well, he's included I accept here, that we use when we have just a thesis or a point of clarification. So he says five answers. With each one of these, the challenger can ask the defender to spell out their answers. So if someone says the reason is not established, that's one reply to that could be, why is the reason not established? Why do you say the reason is not established? That's one way of going about the debate. Of course, there are other tacks you could take, like giving the correct answer. The reason is established because, and then you fill in the answer. Or throwing a consequence. So again, there are these examples here that we can go back and just refresh our memory. Just read through it on your own time and refresh your memory about how to do that so that when you're debating with somebody, then you can add that. Because as far as I know, I'll speak for myself, I'm a beginner at this, and it's good to be reminded to spell these things out. Okay, so there's no privation. Again, if someone gives you that answer, if the defender says there's no privation, well, spell out your answer. What do you mean there's no privation? Then the person could say, it is not the case that whatever is X is necessarily Y. You know, looking at the privation there. And the same thing with the answer, I accept. What is it that you're accepting? I accept that a pot is a functioning thing. Or I accept that sound is impermanent because it's a product. At least this is what we'll be doing as beginners. Now, I read something in the debate book that it's not clear in my mind. I didn't ascertain it. What was it? That at one point, do you remember? At one point, you do say, I accept, and you spell it out. Maybe it was with just the thesis. And if it's a syllogism, I'd have to go back and check. I'm sorry. I've read too much today. we can follow up on that later.
Yes.
I've not been clear about when we talk about spelling things out, is it in the form that you just say, I accept as a defender, and then wait for the challenger to say, why do you accept?
That's how he has said it here. But in, I wonder if I could find it quickly. Probably not. He was talking about how in formal debate, there are times when you say, I accept, and then you say
when
what
you
go
accept.
Ahead
and yeah.
And I can't remember which way it goes, if it's the two-part, the thesis, or if it's the whole syllogism.
Well, actually, as soon as I asked the question, I remember that there's some place where he says, don't give any more than you've been asked for.
Mm-hmm.
So
yes, but there's
that's
also
probably the rule to go by since we don't know.
Sure,
that
for
one.
Now.
Yeah.
Yes, but he was explaining. And, you know, I suspect it depends on where you're debating, who's, you know, I suspect there are different rules at different monasteries and even in different generations of how things are answered. Oh, good. Thank you. What does it say? What page? Right below what?
Right at the next chapter, before we start one special answer. Then in. He says, please practice, do not adopt the habit of automatically spelling out the answers before you have been asked. Wait for the challenger to ask and then do it.
Okay. One special answer, let's just skip over that for now. I didn't reread that today. that's if something can't be ascertained, then you can't posit you can't develop a valid cognition about it, something that you can't ascertain yourself. Okay. Then the next section is more than just these answers. So the defender is not limited to just these answers lined up above. Being a defender is not just limited to a passive position of defending against what is coming your way. If that were the way of Buddhist debate, it would often be very hard for the challenger to understand what the defender believes, and it would be hard for the defender to express his belief. Thus, the defender does not just passively respond, but may also be called upon to posit definitions, divisions, and illustrations, to make a claim about how two phenomena compare, to posit subjects for debate, and give reasons in support of claims, to explain the meaning of a word or a phrase or a definition or a textual passage, and to explain the meaning of a whole passage. So that's a lot that can be going on in a debate. It's not just a very rigid, you know, restricting conversation. And at one point he goes on to say that we might think that the challenger is directing the debate, but actually the defender can direct the debate too by how they answer. Okay, so it's a mutual dance between the two. Yeah, here on 366 he says, some think that the challenger controls where the debate goes, but it seems that the challenger and the defender have rather equal control. The challenger raises the debate topic initially, but after that, all the challenger can do is follow up on what the defender is saying, though there is room for creativity and cleverness in a way the challenger does this. The defender can only respond to the arguments and questions the challenger is stating, but the answers the defender gives determines the way the debate has to go. I think I mentioned before, a friend of mine from Chenrezig was in Dharamsala to learn more Tibetan, but also to learn more about debate. And she was talking with a Tibetan Geshe, and she was asking him a specific question about emptiness. And so she put forward this question. He says, well, it depends. If you answer it this way, da-da-da-da-da. If you answer it this way, da-da-da-da-da. So you see, even in that, and I don't remember what she said about it, but in that example, then you can see that someone can steer that debate by what they're interested in or what they understand, maybe even, or what they feel comfortable with responding. Or you know, they might even be trying to challenge the challenger in a way. Okay, then we had this very detailed section that called The Challenger Responds to the Defender. And we went through this rather quickly. And there's so much in here. I think we could probably just take one of these responses and spend a good long time on it, practicing with it to get really familiar with it, you know, in our free time. So let's just look at these generally to get an overview, to get an idea. So after the defender says why, so the challenger has put forward either a thesis or a point of clarification or a syllogism or a complete consequence, and the defender says why. So there's a couple ways that the challenger can go at this point, right? In that first example, the challenger can ask for a reason. Is that what they're doing there?
Yeah.
So in this first debate, maybe it's helpful if we just read through a couple of them quickly. The defender says, I accept that whatever is a valid, reliable cognizer is necessarily a direct perceiver. So then the challenger gives a consequence to that. Then it follows that the subject, an inferential cognizer realizing sound as an impermanent phenomena by the sign of being a product, is a direct perceiver, meaning it doesn't rely on a generic image or a conceptual appearance. The defender doesn't like that, and so they say, why? Ah, okay. In this first one, the challenger is explaining why. That's what's happening here. I had my notes backwards. So the defender is saying, why? Why are you giving me that absurd consequence? Why is an inferential cognizer realizing sound as an impermanent phenomena by the sign of being a product, a direct perceiver? Now, why are you giving me that absurd consequence? Because of being a valid cognizer. You asserted the pervasion. Okay, so he's explaining why. It doesn't make a lot of sense because it's an absurd consequence. You asserted the pervasion. He's throwing the pervasion back, and that's his answer, hoping to jar the defender to realize their error. In the second way that challenger could go after the defender says why, is to ask for a reason. Okay, so in that one, let's just look at that quickly. On the bottom of 367, it follows that the subject of pot is different from functioning thing. Okay, let's just take that alone. Pot is different from functioning thing, isn't it? Okay. Then if the defender says why, in other words, they don't agree, why is pot different from functioning thing, then you can posit the opposite of it. Then it follows that the subject of pot is not different from functioning thing. So that's another response that could be given. You know, that's a consequence to what the person is saying. If they're not accepting the first one, then would they accept the opposite of that? And if the person says accept, then you say, well, give a reason justifying that. Okay, so these are two different ways of responding when the offender says why to something that's been put forward by the challenger.
Yeah, I think it's very helpful to have a list of how to respond to certain things.
Mm-hmm.
And that's not how it's done in the book. It gives you snippets of debates, and then mm-hmm. you kind of have to wade through and figure out, okay, what's going on here?
Mm-hmm.
Maybe that's something for us to do on our own. But yeah. I'd like to see something like the decision tree for just each of these ways of responding.
Uh-huh.
Where can you go when the defender says this?
Great. I think that's a good thing to do. And yeah, each one of us can do that, and it'll become clearer in our own mind when we do that. All right, so the second one is on 368. After the defender says the reason is not established, where do you go after that? So let's look at that one. So the defender is accepting something. You know, you're right, it's like a snippet in the middle of a debate. So the defender says, I accept that whatever is a color is necessarily red. And challenger posits a consequence. It follows that whatever is a color, they're just following up what's been said. It follows that whatever is a color is necessarily red. The defender accepts that. That's just to really cement what that defender is saying. You've got it, it's like you've got it on tape. Then the challenger follows with, then it would follow that the subject, the color of a white conch, is red. So that's one way of following up. So in this example, he's pulled out an example for that pervasion, right? The pervasion is given, whatever is a color is necessarily red. And so then the challenger comes up with an example, like the white conch. We drop the religious part. The color of a white conch is red. When we have a pervasion like that, I accept that whatever is a color is necessarily red. Color, is the color in that statement the predicate or the reason? It would be in the position of a reason, wouldn't it?
Mm-hmm.
When we check if the pervasion is established, we're looking to see if it's whatever is the reason is necessarily the predicate. And what we've learned before is that the reason needs to be either equal to or smaller than, less than, the predicate. The predicate needs to pervade the reason. That's something that's really worth getting clear in your mind. So that when we look at a statement like this, we know how it's supposed to be. Because I think one of the challenging things about reading these debates is that they don't make sense. And so it can confuse the mind. Like, wait a minute, there's something not quite right there. But I think sometimes we don't have enough confidence in the way it's supposed to be. You know, if you're checking for the pervasion, the reason, if it's the reason, it is necessarily the predicate. So if it's the reason, it needs to be equal to or pervaded by the predicate, smaller than the predicate. So if we said whatever is a color, if that's the reason, whatever is a color, it's necessarily red. Well, red is not able to pervade color, is it? So right away that we should have like a, I guess all of us have different kinesthetic sense. But if you see in pictures, you know, if you see the Venn diagrams, then we could immediately have a little picture like, okay, if that's the case, then red is the pervader. And color, well, if it was correct, red would be pervaded by color. But in the way it's stated here, whatever is a color is necessarily red. It's the opposite way.
But it said whatever is red is necessarily color. But if it said whatever is red is necessarily a color, you would have then the reason would be equal or smaller than the predicate, and then it would work.
So the point I'm making is it's good to know in a correct reason how it should be, so that when we get a syllogism, we can very quickly check. It's so familiar in our mind. Like, for instance, the color of a red fire truck is red, is a color because it's red. For all intents and purposes, let's just say that's the correct reason. There's someone wanting to know if the color of a red fire truck is a color, okay? So in that syllogism, the color of a red fire truck is a color because it's red. Whatever is red is necessarily a color. Whatever is red, smaller category, is necessarily a color. But if someone said the opposite, so just to see how you check the pervasion. Now, someone could just give the pervasion. Whatever is red is necessarily color. So we're just taking it, we're extracting it from a complete syllogism to start seeing the relationship. Yeah, that's the point I'm making. So that when we come across something that whatever is a color is necessarily red, we'll have something to compare it to. At this point, I still have to stop and check. Let's see. No, red is not pervading color, so something's not right there. In this section, he gives a nice explanation of how you would go about proving that the reason is established. Is that right? Okay, so we've gone through this. I accept that whatever is a color is necessarily red. It follows that whatever is a color is necessarily red. I accept. Then it would follow. We're taking an example. Then it would follow that the subject, the color of a white conch, is red. That's an absurd consequence. This person says, why? Why is the color of a white conch red? Because of being a color, you asserted the pervasion. So we're taking the pervasion that they've asserted, that they've agreed to, and we're putting it into a syllogism with our own example. The reason that the color of a white religious conch shell is a color is not established. That's all that person can say because they've asserted the pervasion. You see? They've accepted that pervasion. They've asserted that pervasion. So all they can say, if they want to keep debating, is the reason's not established. So then the challenger has to establish, well, is going to show that the reason is established. So then, okay, so it follows the subject, the color of a white conch is a color because of being white. So what he's done, first of all, he said the color of a white, well, we're going to get to this later, so... Well, no, we need to understand it now. Okay. it follows that the subject, the color of a white conch shell, is red, and then he gives a reason because being a color. So this person is saying that reason, that the color of a white conch is a color, is not established. So... then that the challenger is going to say it follows that the subject, the color of a white conch, same subject, is a color. Now he's taking the reason, putting it in the place of the predicate. It is a color, and then he's giving a new reason, because it's white. So just consider that if you're debating with someone, you've given a syllogism, they say the reason's not established, and you know that the reason is established, then what would you do next? You would use that same subject, take the reason, put it in the place of the predicate, because that's what you're trying to prove, right? When we check, is the reason established? We're looking at the subject and the reason. Put the reason in the space of the predicate and then give a new reason that hopefully is easier for that person to understand. Then they can come around and say, okay, I accept. Okay, so Devendra says... all consciousnesses are anger. Whatever is a consciousness is necessarily anger. That's in a syllogistic form, isn't it? I was trying to follow the format here in the book. Well, it starts with the defender. I accept that whatever is a color.
Yeah, okay. I see. Okay. Yeah. Thank you. That's right. I accept that all consciousnesses are anger. Okay. Then, Venerable Jampa, what do you think happens next?
Oh, let's see. Do you see it follows?
Oh, yeah. Okay. It follows. Here. Help me out. It follows that all. So, the defender is going to say, I accept, right? Yep. Yep. Okay.
And then the challenger is going to take this absurd consequence here and is going to think about something that is a consciousness, but it's not anger, and use that as the subject. So this is a little bit different language than the point I was making earlier is to see the relationship. So we could say this in terms of whatever is a consciousness is necessarily anger. So consciousness is going to be like the reason, and it's the smaller of the two. And anger is going to be like the reason. Yes, yes, but in reality, if it was a correct reason, yes, that's true. But if this were, let's look at how it should be. What is the relationship as it should be? And this is the predicate, it should be larger, okay? Whatever is a consciousness is necessarily anger, but as you're pointing out, that's not the situation. If we were looking at a pervasion, the relationship should be that the what's at the end of the statement should be the larger of the two. It should pervade back on the reason. But this is not happening in this case. Anger does not pervade consciousness, okay? So in that case, then, we're going to think of what is an example of something. It follows, okay? Let's give an absurd consequence of that. It follows that. Now, what is something that is a consciousness that's not anger? It follows that I consciousness is anger because it's a consciousness. You asserted the pervasion, that whatever is a consciousness is necessarily anger. Okay? So, we've come up with our own example, and then we've applied it to the pervasion that was accepted earlier. Okay? Then this person has to accept the pervasion because they asserted it, right? And so they can't say no pervasion. So they're going to say, why? No, no, they're going to say reason not established. Do they say why? They say why. Okay, they'll say why. Right. Why?
They say why first.
Right.
Say why and then the challenge.
Oh, I see. Okay. Right, they say why, and then we'd say, because it's a consciousness, you asserted the pervasion. But I just did it all in one. Okay, so now they say, reason not established. I never understood why you would break that up. But I guess there would be points in the debate where you would just give the first part, follows that I consciousness is anger, and then wait for them to say why. Maybe it helps the penny to drop. I don't know. So but I think you
could say accept it.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, not in this absurd case, but, well, I mean, all absurd things don't seem absurd in the moment. And they might accept, yeah. Okay, so then the reason is not established. And this is the point of this section, like, what do you do when someone says, the reason is not established? So then, what happens next? I was going to say E, but it's actually back to C. So, what do you think would happen next? What's one way of going with this? If someone says, the reason is not established that I consciousness is a consciousness. So you use the same subject. It follows. Follows that I consciousness is a consciousness.
Yes.
And then now we have to supply a new reason to prove that the reason is established.
you can adjust the divine consciousness.
Definition is one of the best reasons you can give in any situation. Is a consciousness because it's clear and knowing. So here are the pieces. You know, you could take any relationship where one is bigger than the other and reverse them in the pervasion. Just make more and more examples of that. And I think that it will slowly make sense of what's happening here. And that's why they recommended that we repeat these things again and again, right? In fact, just reading them back and forth to each other until they start to make... So you start to see, oh, that's how this works. Yeah.
So what I wrote down is, how can a challenger respond to a defender when they say the reason is not established? What's going on here is that the challenger says the subject is the reason, which has now become the predicate, and gives a new reason.
Mm-hmm.
That could be just like, you know, just a line. Here's what you do.
Yeah, good. Mm-hmm. All right, you're coming up with your clear chart or whatever it is of how to proceed.
Yeah.
Good.
And then I was wondering, when do you repeat? Like, because
repeat?
That the first challenger's statement and the second defender's statement can be just taken out, you know.
Mm-hmm.
It's redundant. But I see they do that sometimes, and I'm not sure how you know when.
Mm-hmm. Was it you who was saying sometimes they may do that just to give them a few more minutes to think? But also, you're really pinning someone down to their position. So I accept that all consciousness is our anger. Well, so it follows. What you're saying, you're really saying that all consciousness is our anger. Yeah, I accept that. So now there's no doubt what that person has said. Sometimes the debates are going so fast, too. I wonder if some of it might just be to make sure that you're understanding that person clearly. That's what I know. You want to add anything to that? Or anybody want to add something? Uh-huh.
Them produces, it's incremental. Right, you really just go one small step at a time. And like you said, it's very, very fast. And in Tibetan, to say I accept takes a very short time. It's like you're just spitting out that answer. So it goes... And it actually helps, I think, to have it like that,
mm-hmm.
step by step. So like you said, so it's super clear
mm-hmm.
where you're going.
At this point of... where the defender has said, I accept,
mm-hmm.
could they have realized their mistake? And then what do they do then? They go, that's what we do. And it doesn't seem to, we don't seem to know where to go there.
Uh-huh.
So they could say, I don't accept. Or I retract my statement. What do they do then?
I have gotten the impression that they would go ahead and finish out the debate and wait for the sa. Because they've already committed themselves. And they might even be debating half-heartedly at that point because they know they've made a mistake.
But if they've made a mistake, Daniel says that he's seen Westerners keep debating when they know they're wrong, but that's not right. So, and what if this is only a sidetrack of a bigger debate? You could just say, oh, that's not right, and they could go back to get back on track. I don't know.
Yeah. Yeah, I don't actually know. I think the difference here would be a person knows they're mistaken. They're not going to be just debating to be obnoxious. Like, that's not the point of debate, is it? Or to win, that's not the point of debate. So... I mean, I suspect that happens sometimes. You know, egos get involved. But the purpose really is to understand. So if two people are debating with a good motivation, then I don't know exactly, you know, if you realize your mistake earlier on, maybe you would just say, okay, I see. Or either of you know? Yeah, please.
I think
just sit there and cry. No, because whenever I've given a wrong answer, right, the tutor yells three spheres. Yeah, I think it's somewhere in the notes that you're talking about. Like, check. It's basically checkmate. But there's like a hand action, and they yell at you, like even before they reply, "Kosum," and tell you, and you're like, "Oh no, I'm wrong. Help!" I don't know. It's the stylistics of it. Yeah. I think.
What is your response to
it? No, you're just supposed to stay clear, and it's they would just yell that before, so you know you've accepted a totally absurd consequence. They would yell that before saying it follows their eye consciousness is anger, because
and they would still go through the steps.
But the yelling is like shoot. Uh-huh.
Well, humility is part of the practice.
But in this case, then the defender just gives another garbage comment of no, that reason is not established.
No. I think if I, let's see. Okay, so if you really understood that your mistake up here, I wonder, would you continue saying reason not established? I think you would just let the challenger finish out.
Yeah, well, at some point you would have to do that. And, and if you already realized it, you wouldn't accept. I don't. Maybe the challenger would just steer it somewhere else then.
Yeah, I suspect some of this is nuance. Like if you're looking at your opponent, you realize that they understand their mistake. Unless you're really sadistic, you wouldn't like pound them on it. I don't know how. This is a good question, and this would be the real benefit of having debate taught by people who have done a lot of debate, which is not me. it's hard to learn debate from books. It's hard to learn debate without practice, and it's hard to learn debate without people who can give you the oral instructions of debate. So at some point, I mean, all due respect to Venerable Chodron, and she's got an incredibly sharp mind, but I don't know that she's even done debate on the debate court like some people. So, you know, at some point it would be ideal if we could have someone come for a period of time and just run through these debates with us, and we can ask him these kinds of questions. And in the meantime, I'll write to Venerable Dunya and ask him.
All right, so maybe that's enough for reason not established. They do include these nice diagrams, like on page 370. I don't know how you find that. Do you see the diagrams in the book where it's showing you, follows that the subject, the color of a white conch is red because of being a color, and then it shows you how the old predicate drops out, and the old reason becomes the new predicate. So it's showing you where you're moving things and how to proceed with the debate. And, okay. Then after the defender says there's no pervasion, let's look at one of those. It follows that the subject uncomposed space, put on your sutra hat, it follows that the subject uncomposed space is not a product because of being a conventional truth. Is that a correct statement from a sutra school point of view? It is, isn't it? Uncomposed space. Yes. Yeah, ultimate truths are truths that are, ultimate truths are that which is able to ultimately perform a function, meaning an impermanent phenomena. Yes, that's correct. Okay, but the defender says there's no pervasion. In other words, it's not the case that whatever is a conventional truth is necessarily a product, probably a middle way consequentialist. Okay, so what does this person do? They give the correct answer. It follows that whatever is a conventional truth is necessarily not a product, and then they give a reason. Why? Because a common locus of the two, product and conventional truth, does not exist. We'll leave it at that. I was thinking, you know, the reason needs to be something that's easier. So, I would always look to see, is there a way you can use a definition, or is there a way you can use something that's going to make it crystal clear for that person? Okay. Then the next section, after the defender says the pervasion is opposite, let's look at one of those. page 372. So there's a lot in this chapter. And no wonder, you know, we're feeling, I get the impression I'm feeling a little bit bogged down, and it really helped to go back through and just walk through, like, well, of course, there's so much information here. It's a little bit overwhelming. Yeah.
So with the one that, with the, the one about uncomposed base, couldn't the challenger at that point posit, say, something along the lines of bringing up the definition as far as asking the...
Well, that's in the next section, or that's included there in that section under there is no pervasion. So the first example is that the challenger gives a correct answer. Another way the challenger can go with that is to ask for the reason. That's right.
Right, but I'm saying he could ask for the definition. Could say the definition of conventional truth can't be posited, because maybe they're figuring out that, oh, this defendant doesn't know how they define conventional truth. You could take it off on a sidetrack like that and say the definition of a conventional truth cannot be posited, and then try to get them to posit it, and then so that they see what they're comparing.
Yeah, that does take it off in a different direction, and the impression that I've gotten is that you're staying much more closely to the script, at least as beginners. Now, I don't know, maybe very advanced meditators can go all over the board, but I think that following along what you're saying, if a person says there's no pervasion, that whatever is a conventional truth is necessarily not a product, then you might posit the opposite of that, trying to ferret out what is their understanding of conventional truth, you know?
Yeah, I saw the next example.
They posit the opposite. But what I was thinking was with the first reason he gives, because a common locus of the two, product and conventional truth, does not exist, if the person doesn't really understand what they're comparing, that's not going to help. Because they're going to just, what I was thinking is you could go into the definition in order to clarify we are comparing.
Yeah. That would probably come out. So if we pause it, if the challenger gives that third statement there, it follows that whatever is a conventional truth is necessarily not a product, because a common locus of the two, product and conventional truth, does not exist. They would probably say reason not established if they didn't understand what a conventional truth was. And then you would go out. I think each time they don't understand, you have a chance to clarify it, and then bring them back to the original statement that you're trying to. And in fact, this kind of comes together in the example of whatever is a color is necessarily red debate at the end of this chapter. And so hopefully we'll have a little bit of time to get to that, just to see how it can run out its course, go through these different side debates, and then come back to the main debate, just to show that. Yeah. Okay, but I like Venerable Khunga's idea, and it would be a very good one, to go through these and get clear in your own mind, well, what are the two examples that are being given here of how to respond? And put it in whatever words make sense for you, so that you would know if you're the challenger and the defender says any of these responses, that you would know, okay, I have a choice. I can go this way, I can go that way. So that would be helpful, wouldn't it? Okay, so pervasion is opposite, is similar to no pervasion. And then I accept is pretty straightforward. Okay, then he gives us, so that little section that we've just painstakingly gone through, I think we could spend a long time just learning those and really trying to understand what their purpose is, where they're trying to go. It's just the power of repetition again and again. So keep that in mind. Maybe flag that in your book as something to come back to. To spend more time with. Like I said, that's kind of like, that's the deep end splash right there. We've just been tossed into the deep end. and given a lot of information about how to proceed. Then the next section, he's giving us a few ideas of how to start debates. And again, this should be, I think this should be fairly familiar to us because we have done some of these short debates, you know, in the reviews and with Venerable. So you can start with a consequence, like in the first example on page 375. The person starts with D, the subject just in the way Manjushi debated it. It's the first debate of the day, so they say that statement. And then they can say it as a question. Is whatever is a color necessarily red? Or they could state it just as a consequence. Whatever is a color is necessarily red. And then you're off and running. The person has something to respond to, either accepting or saying why. In the second section, it's asking, this is how you would start when you are looking at definitions. It follows that there is no definition of a functioning thing. It follows the definition of functioning thing can't be posited. Okay, that's, we've done a lot of that. The next page is looking at division. It follows that there is no division of colors into two. Or you could say it follows that the divisions of colors can't be posited. So different ways, different phrases that you can use. And then, although in my mind, illustrations is still kind of a gray area, a fuzzy area, if you wanted to ask for illustrations, you could do that. Follows that there is no illustration of a sense-direct perceiver apprehending a visible form. I accept. I just am not 100% clear about illustrations, so I won't even say anything about that. Okay, so, wow, there's a lot there. And I suspect this is exactly why Venerable suggested that we go back to some of the basics and the basics in this chapter to review and review and review again. So we have about 25 minutes left. And on page 378, under the heading Reviewing the Defender's Answers, Venerable has not covered this yet. Okay, so I'm not pretending to teach this or go ahead of what she has offered us. She's offered us a lot. At the same time, next week she'll be sitting up here going through this page. And I thought it might be a bit of encouragement if we were to just begin walking through this debate. It's a classic debate. I think it's fair to say that some of the reasoning or some of the explanation is not spelled out here. So if we walk through this, maybe we can just fill out some of the blanks, some of the question marks that we have. Is that agreeable? Okay. And then we have a little bit of a head start, and Venerable will be so happy to know that we've read a bit ahead. All right. So we're on page 378, reviewing the defender's answers. So let's just read through this, and I've got some cheat sheets. There's a beautiful description of this debate in a lot of detail in this debate book, the first debate book by Dan Perdue. I'll give you some page numbers. Yeah, on page 99, the procedure in debate, chapter 5, procedure in debate, it goes through this in painstaking detail. So if you want to read more about it, this is a very good place to go. This must not be the first debate of the day. It didn't start with D, but the challenger says, it follows that whatever is a color is necessarily red. Okay, so that's a pervasion. So you're thinking about, normally, the reason. I always have to stop and think about this. Whatever is the reason is necessarily the predicate. That's how I think about it. Whatever is the reason is necessarily the predicate. So whatever is a color, the first one is going to be the reason and the space of the reason. Whatever is a color is necessarily red. So can you see that in your mind? Whatever is a color is necessarily red. Which circle is bigger? Not in this, in the way it's stated here. Yeah. Yes. Right. See, now this is the challenge. The mind is going, no, that's not right. It should be this way. But this is a pervasion. It follows that whatever, it's a consequence of a pervasion. It follows that whatever is a color is necessarily red. So if we were to put this into a syllogism, like the color of a red fire truck is red because it's a color. That's what they're saying. Okay, so the color of a red fire truck is a color. The reason is established, but whatever is a color is not necessarily red. For example, blue. So this is an erroneous pervasion. But, you know, again, this is probably the middle of a debate, and so the way he describes it in debate is this is a sutra proponent debating with a non-sutra proponent. Maybe even a non-Buddhist, I don't know. Okay, so then the defender says, I accept, because they hold this assertion. This is what they agree with. Well, wait a minute. First of all, let's back up. If the challenger said, it follows that whatever is a color is necessarily red, what are your choices there? What are possible answers if you're given a pervasion? Yeah, I accept or why? Okay, so before we were looking at a subject and a predicate, or a subject and the predicate and a consequence, which is called a point of clarification. But here we're looking at a pervasion. So we can say why or I accept even with a pervasion. That's good to keep in mind too. Okay, so here this person says I accept. I accept that whatever is a color is necessarily red. Okay, and he says this is the defender's fundamental bad answer. Okay, so now we saw this before. When a person says I accept, now we're going to think of a subject to form a syllogism using that pervasion. We're going to think of a subject that will highlight the error of this erroneous pervasion. Okay, so then it follows that the subject, the color of a conch, the color of a white conch, is red. Because red is in the position of the predicate in that syllogism. It comes at the end. So that's the predicate. Does that make sense? Okay. So it follows the subject, the color of a white conch is red. And so, of course, the defender is going to say, why? Because they would probably know that a white conch is not red. Again, keep in mind that this debate is really for the purpose of explaining the procedure of debate. Okay, so they say why. And then we give a reason. Because of being a color, you asserted that pervasion. So we've come up with the challenger's come up with an example to bring out some discomfort with that pervasion. Now, in these two statements, the challenger has given a full syllogism, right? The color, it follows that the subject, the color of a white religious conch, a white conch is red because of being a color. So then what's the first thing we do when we have a full syllogism? Check to see if the reason is established. Okay, so is the color of a white conch a color? Well, unfortunately, because this defender has put forward this pervasion, they can't say that there's no pervasion. So they're going to hold on to their guns and say, reason not established, even though to all sensible people, the reason is established, right? Okay. So now we're going to move away from the main debate and go off to a side debate to show that the reason is indeed established. Okay? Follows that the subject, the color of a white conch, is a color because of being... that's the next. All right, so then it follows that the subject, the color of a white conch, is a color because of being white. So do you see what he's done here? He's used the same subject. This is like what we were doing before in that example. It follows that the subject, the color of the white conch, same subject, Now we're going to take the reason, because we're trying to prove that the property of the subject, that the reason is a property of the subject. Okay, so the color of a white conch is a color. Why? Because of being white. So we've given a new syllogism. It's painstaking to write this on the board, but if it's helpful, we can do it. No, not necessary? Okay. All right, so... So color, the reason of the earlier consequence, color becomes the new point of clarification, because it's a consequence, point of clarification, in this consequence. And the challenger gives a new reason in support of the new point of clarification. So if someone said the color of a white, it follows that the subject, the color of a white conch, is a color because of being white. This particular defender says the reason is not established. They're still holding to their erroneous ways, okay? So if they were to spell that out, then it would say the reason that the color of a white conch is white, looking at the subject and the reason, is not established. Another bad answer, he says. Okay, so then he's going to give one more answer to try to prove to this person. It follows that the subject, the color of a white conch, is white because of being one with the color of a white conch. Now, how many of you are really, really familiar with that one with and one with anything? It's a little bit of a difficult answer, isn't it? I thought, what if he had said, it follows the subject, the color of a white conch is white because it's suitable to be a white hue. It's a definition. It seems easier to me, but I don't, who am I? What do I know? Maybe it's too easy. I don't know. There is a nice explanation of why this answer works on page 119 in this book. I'll leave it to you to read that. I read it again, and it's still... It seems like circular logic to me, but anyway. Just as before, that one, just as before, the reason in the earlier consequence, white becomes the new point of clarification. What about that, Venerable?
He's just showing the procedure.
Yeah, he's showing.
I think he did that just to be able to go through that particular procedure, to show you the procedure, rather than just giving the definition.
No, you could do the same procedure, just have a different, you'd have a definition there instead of one with. The point is that everything is one with itself. It comes down to that. Like cup is one with cup. It's only one with cup. It's one with itself. So, and the two would be different. The subject is, if we're looking at this, the color of a white conch shell is one with the color of white conch shell. I don't know. Didn't work for me. I'm not Tibetan.
in common language, we would just say, of course it's white. It's a white religious, it's a white shell.
Okay, maybe like that.
You just said it was a white shell. I mean, that's kind of what he's meaning, isn't it?
Well, I hadn't thought of it that way.
How can you say it's white and it's not white?
Yeah, maybe it's like that. Thank you. Yeah, I like your explanation much better than page 119. Okay, so he's just trying to give another answer, and perhaps this person is already very well-versed in one with. Okay, so then finally that defender is going to accept that. So he says, I accept that the color of the white conch shell is white. Okay, he says, I accept that the color of a white conch is white. All right, so then this person says, ta. Gotcha. It follows that the color of a white conch is a color. The reason he's showing that the conch shell is white is to prove that it's a color, right? So he's taking us back. He said ta, but it doesn't seem to be sa on the very... the thing that is most previous. Does that make sense? Is there a better way to say that? this is not 100% clear in my mind to be able to explain it clearly, but let's just take a look in here and see if we can understand it. Okay, so he says tsa, because the person has accepted finally that what he's saying is correct. He's going to accept that the subject, the color of a white conch, is white because of being one with the color white. I accept that. So it seems that if he accepts that, then it follows that the subject, the color of a white religious conch, is a color. You, based on what you've just accepted, then you would also accept that the color, we're working backwards now, that the color of a white religious conch shell is a color. So this person really has no place to go except to say, I accept. And then we're going to move back to the next, the most previous statement. It follows that the subject, the color of a white religious conch shell, Then he goes back to, clarifies the first point he brought up. It follows that the subject, the color of a white religious conch shell, is red because of being a color. So he goes back to the absurd consequence. Why? Okay. I drew it out on a little piece of paper. See if I can understand it. All right. When this defender said the reason is not established, that the reason that a color of a white religious conch is a color is not established, that followed from the consequence that he had thrown before. It follows that the color of a white conch is necessarily red because of being a color. This person said, well, the color of a white conch is not a color. Okay, so then it follows that the subject, the color of a white conch, is a color because of being white. Reason not established, that the color of a white conch is white. It follows that the subject, the color of a white conch, is white because of being one with the color of a white conch. Okay, then I accept. Okay, if you accept that, then you'll accept the previous statement that it follows that the color of a white conch is a color. I accept. It follows that the subject, the color of a white conch, is a color. So you're working backwards, and now that they've accepted this one on the very end, that means that they will accept the previous one. You get them to accept that. You take it back to the most previous, the one previous to that. Okay, so the first saw, it follows that the color of a white conch is a color. I accept. And then you would say tsa again. It follows that the subject, the color of a white conch, is red because of being a color. So you've worked back to the original absurd consequence. Okay, so where do you go?
Which you have, of course, remembered step by step.
Well.
In the opposite order.
Yeah. This is what a good meditator will do. Maybe this is another reason they get you to memorize all these debates. At least you have a few things in your head. And it requires extremely good listening. And memory, yeah. You can see how this sharpens your mind. Yes?
This is a sample debate, right? If you really are trying to prove your point, you will remember everything. And that's why I had to write a debate with my mom, because I will remember everything she said and what I'm trying to prove. And that helped me to get the process down. So if you work with a subject you really want to make your point around, I feel this kind of falls into place.
Excellent. Thank you for sharing that. Yeah. Okay, so we'll have to watch for things we really want to prove this week. And okay, so that has brought us back to the original absurd consequence. It follows that the color of a white conch... Okay, and now instead of saying the same absurd consequence, he's going to change it just a little bit. So it follows that the color of a white conch is not red because of being white. You see where we are? Okay. So now he's going to take a different tack, because we have established that the reason is established. So now he's going to change the predicate a little bit. He's going to challenge that person's pervasion. Sorry, not predicate, pervasion. All right? Okay, so... Those first volleys there are proving that the reason is established in that absurd consequence. Once he's established that the reason is established, now he's going to start challenging the pervasion that was originally established. So he says it follows that the color of a white conch is not red because of being white. Okay, let's just look at what he says. I don't know how to explain this in this moment, but it follows that the color of a white conch is not red because of being white. Now, this person has already accepted that the color of a white conch is white. So now he is trying to make inroads into the predicate. This person is going to say, no pervasion, that whatever is white is necessarily not red. Seems odd. but whatever, okay. So then, I'm not sure this is, okay. So then the challenger says, let's just keep going. It follows that whatever is white is necessarily not red because a common locus of the two, white and red, does not exist. So he's trying to prove. This person said no pervasion. So now if someone says no pervasion, the defender says no pervasion, then we have a couple of choices of what we can do. This person is supplying, the challenger is supplying an answer. It follows that whatever is white is necessarily not red, proving the pervasion, right? And then he gives a reason, because a common locus of the two, white and red, does not exist. Now, we might say, wait a minute, what about pink? Isn't that the common locus of white and red? Well, no, because pink is not white and it's not red. Or if you had something that was striped, it has had red stripes and white stripes, that is still not red and white, the two. Okay, so something that is the two, red and white, does not exist. So here the defender says that reason, that a common locus of the two, white and red, does not exist. Now notice that to say the reason is not established, he's just looking at the reason. Remember when we have, that reason is like a complete statement in itself. He doesn't even have to relate that to the subject. Do you remember we covered that point in the text? So he's saying the reason that a common locus of the two, white and red, does not exist, is not established. So then the challenger is going to establish that for him. It follows that a common locus of the two, so now he's taking the reason just by itself. It follows that the common locus of the two, white and red, does not exist. Why? Because those two are mutually exclusive. So white and red are mutually exclusive, meaning they're different, and a common locus is not possible of the two. So then at that point, the person comes to their senses and says, I accept. Common locus of the two, white and red, does not exist. So guess what the challenger is going to say? Ta. Okay, if you accept that a common locus of the two, white and red, does not exist, then we can jump back to the previous line that the challenger said and say, it follows that whatever is white is necessarily not red. And if that person, No, don't say why. And if the person says, I accept that whatever is white is necessarily not red, then we jump back one more to what the challenger said before. It follows that the subject, the color of a white conch, is not red. That's where we jumped off at this point. That person says, I accept. And then, again, he's really having a good time with this. We jump back to, it follows that the subject, the color of a white conch, is red. Now he's throwing the pervasion. You see, we started this whole section here with saying the color, it follows the color of a white conch is not red because of being white. But now he's going back to the absurd consequence of the defender saying, it follows that the subject, the color of a white conch, is red because of being a color. You asserted the reason and the pervasion, both. Yeah. And then, so is there something, so in tsar is different than tsa, evidently, like, Oh, in here it says, oh, ta, ta, ta. I see. In this text it says tsar, and it has with an R on the end, meaning you are really finished. Okay, but what about ta? Does that mean finished too? Same. Okay. There was a distinction in the debate book. All right. I wish I had more skillful means to share with you. But hopefully, just going through that, seeing how you go forward, and then once you reach a certain point of acceptance from the defender, then you start working your way back, and you get that person to accept all the things that they have not accepted previously until you get back to your original absurd consequence, and then eventually you'll be able to get them to reverse their pervasion. So this is something that I think we could spend a lot of practice time on, maybe with, you know, maybe using the things that we already know, like functioning thing and matter, or you know, the simple categories that will stand out very obviously to us for the debate of learning it. I just made a table with I found it helpful. Actually, I got this idea. Well, actually, this is how a lot of the texts are. You'll see them in column form like this. And also, Venerable Lamsel was sharing with me some things that she had done like this. And so I just wanted to be able to see it more clearly. And so I wanted to see, well, these are the main points. And then look, here you have to go over here to a diversion to prove that the reason is established. And then you come back up that chain, and then you go back to your original, if you can see what I'm pointing to. But then you have a new thesis here, or a new syllogism, new consequence, and then you have to prove all those side points. And then doing the reverse, again, I have to see things. It visually helps me. And in a book, it all becomes just a blur of words. So if I can put it in some kind of form or colors that help me see who's saying what, and yeah, so I'm happy to share. Yeah, so whatever tricks work for you, if you need to circle things to see how they move, or, you know, make the little arrows like he does here. He circles the predicate and draws an arrow down. That doesn't work so much. Okay, well, you'll find something that works for you. Sing it. Okay. I do feel that tonight was not as clear as I would have liked it to have been, but there you go. I started with a good motivation. I hope you did too. Okay. It really would be such a benefit to get someone here who has done a lot of debate and also is willing to do it in English. That'd be really helpful. There would be no other option, but there aren't that many people who are willing to do it in English. So we'll see if we can work on that one. Okay, so let's rejoice that we have interest in debate, that we have interest in working with our minds and understanding hidden phenomena. For the express purpose of purifying our minds so that we can come out of suffering and for the sake of all sentient beings. So we can rejoice that we've created some merit through our attempts tonight to clarify our minds and clarify this chapter, and then we can dedicate.